Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. We're going to talk for a while now about what it means to be a neighbor. Those people who live near us, share similar daily routines, share space on the bus. The people who help make your home feel like home because they're part of your neighborhood's landscape. If you think that some of your neighborly relationships aren't what they once were, or aren't what your parents' or grandparents' experience with neighbors were, you're not alone. Half of all Americans in a recent survey said they didn't know most of their neighbors at all. That is quite a change from decades past. But what does it mean for our society, our politics, our future? That's the subject tackled in a new book called The Vanishing Neighbor, The Transformation of American Community. It's out in stores this month. And joining us now to talk more about his book is Mark Dunkelman. He's a research fellow at Brown University's Taubman Center for Public Policy and American Institutions. And he joins us now from Brown. Mark, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, we want you to be part of this conversation. You might know your Facebook friends. You might have a lot of Twitter followers. But do you know your neighbors? And if you don't know your neighbors, does that matter? How does it matter? We want to know if you feel like something is lost when you don't know the people across the street or next door or even living just upstairs. When those kind of relationships don't exist, how does that change the way we live? Mark Dunkelman, who's here with me, makes the case that our political system is broken in part because we've lost that social cohesion. We want to know if you agree. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Mark, your thesis has been out there for a while now. You know, the idea that something has shifted in the U.S. since the 1950s, which many people think of so nostalgically. You know, there are no more Elks clubs. You know, but do you think it? You clearly do think it matters. So, on the other hand, we have ways to keep in touch now that past generations couldn't even fathom. So why do you think this matters?
Well, the reason that it matters is that the relationships you have with people who are familiar but not intimate, who are not your best friends or your family, and neither are they people with whom you agree on the internet about politics or a sports team or whatnot. Those relationships that you had in the PTA or with the person across the street were the vehicle by which Americans learned to understand how other people viewed the world. They were our access to understanding why people thought different things, and they were essentially the crucial mortar that made it so that we were willing to accept compromise in the course of our political system. Absent those relationships, and what's really important to recognize is that we're not isolated today. Too often conversations about community turn on whether we're more connected or less connected. The truth is that we're connected to different kinds of people. There are different buckets of relationships that now claim our time and attention, and there are ripple effects from that change. And they're good ripple effects, and there are ones that aren't so good. But this feeling that we all have today that Washington has gone completely askew is driven, I think, much more by what's happening at the neighborhood level than it is even in what's happening in Washington itself.
Mark, you just referred to buckets of relationships, and in your book you have this great analogy involving Jupiter's rings. Could you explain that analogy?
Yeah. If you think about your entire social universe, so you take all the people you know, from the person that you woke up next to this morning to the barista that gave you a latte yesterday, and you put them on a scheme that looks like the rings of Saturn, putting the most intimate people in the inner rings and then successively less intimate people further and further out. My argument is that over the course of the last several decades, for the first time in American history, we've taken our time and attention and invested it much more in the innermost rings and the outermost rings. And what's happened is that the middle rings have been thinned out.
And explain who might fall into that middle ring category. In my life, in your life, who might that be?
It's your neighbor. It's the person who you knew from the PTA. It's the person who was in the Elks Club. These are people that you would know well enough to have a conversation, a serious conversation, about several aspects of their life. If their kids are failing in algebra, if their parents are sick, if their spouse just lost their job. But they're not people that you would necessarily confide in for intimate information. So these are sort of middling relationships that are familiar but not intimate.
So you think those end up being the neglected relationships. So even though these are people that might be right next door, we actually on a daily basis have more interaction with the barista, to use your example, than we might with our upstairs or downstairs neighbors.
Yeah, a barista, or maybe you're a crochet enthusiast and you're on a blog where you've got contacts who are trading different patterns with one another. Those are people you don't know a lot about. You're both interested in crochet or in knitting, but you don't know the things that you would likely know or would have known two generations ago about the person who lived across the hall or whose kid was also in your fourth grader's class.
And talk more about what you think is lost when that middle ring category no longer has as much relevance in your life, or you just don't feel like you have the time or energy to devote to it. You're saying in some ways you're exposed to different views and that narrows your view of the world?
The relationships in the inner rings are people that love you no matter what. The relationships in the outer rings are relationships that hinge on a single affinity, so shared affinity. So if the person at the other end of your outer ring relationship loses interest in crochet, you'll drop that relationship immediately. It was in those middle rings where you met people who had different points of view. It was in those middle rings where a progressive college professor and a conservative independent businesswoman would actually have a conversation and begin to understand what the other thinks. And there are all sorts of advantages to the fact that if you are a cancer researcher today, you can, through the outer rings, be in touch with many thousands of colleagues who are working on similar projects all around the globe. That's a clear advantage of the outer rings. There are also advantages to be had in the middle rings. And so we are prioritizing one set of relationships over another, and there are costs and benefits to the shift.
Listeners, I'm talking with Mark Dunkelman. He has a new book out called The Vanishing Neighbor. It's about how sometimes the people in our immediate lives, on our blocks, maybe in our same two-family or three-family home, we are much less connected to than we were or that our parents or grandparents were. And he believes that has real consequences for how we see the world, live our life, even for our political systems. We want to know if that is your experience, if that you feel like your neighbor relationships are the weakest ones in your lives, and what's lost in that case. 1-800-909, I was about to give the fundraising number. It's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Mark Dunkelman, you know, part of what you're getting at, I think, is this kind of weird paradox today that, you know, we have these online relationships that are often very intense and very frequent, you know, where we spend so much time on our computer and on our phones. But that these online relationships somehow correspond with a loss of close personal relationships. On the other hand, for people who do spend a lot of time on, say, Facebook, it puts you in touch with a very broad, diverse group of people. So do those relationships, those Facebook, social media, online relationships, make up for the neglected relationships maybe with the people who live next door to us?
There are advantages and disadvantages to both relationships. I now know much more about many more of my fourth grade peers because many of us are on Facebook and we see when one has a baby or one is washing her socks or one is frustrated because her child is refusing to be potty trained, whatever it is. I know that information. What I know less about in many cases are what's happening in the life of the person who lives next door. And in that relationship a generation ago, I would have had a much fuller sense in many cases because we would have talked on the street, we would have seen each other at the coffee shop, we would have kibitzed on the outside of a PTA meeting or a Rotary Club meeting. More significant information is going to be shared in a face-to-face conversation than is going to be shared on a Facebook post. So we have a wider breadth of people we know less about, and in the case of these middle ring relationships, we are spending less time getting to know those neighbors.
Mark, we have several callers who want to weigh in. So let me go to Joe, who is calling from Florida, Melbourne, Florida. Joe, you're on the air on Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. When I heard the topic, I had to call. I was in Miami during Hurricane Andrew, and a lot of my work was post-trauma and PTSD support. Worked considerably in Homestead. And there was a lot of press about the fact that people who lived across the street, behind a home for 20 years, didn't know the name, had never met their neighbors. Now, one of the issues, of course, is the heat down here doesn't doesn't promote walking around the neighborhood.
Everyone's inside with the air conditioning.
Absolutely. But what I have found, I live about 200 miles north now, but I've had canines all my life, working dogs. And one of the best antidotes I found is the neighborhood I live in. I don't know a lot of everyone's names, but I probably recognize every face in the neighborhood in Melbourne that I live in. They all wave. A number of us have communicated. I've got a liberal Massachusetts bent, but and most of my neighbors are pretty conservative. But there is a common denominator, and that's, in this case, my dog, and it opens up the conversation. So, one, the fact that we are all busy really prevents the kind of things that I saw in 67, and we all knew each other in the neighborhood. Everyone's neighbor told our parents what we were doing, if we were sneaking a cigarette or causing trouble. And it's no between the transit society we have and transient society we have and how busy we are, this gap exists. But I would only suggest that people seeing that look for ways to interact. And for me, it's been a pet, a dog.
The dog park. Joe, thank you very much for calling. And Mark Dunkelman, your thoughts on that? You know, what are the things that bring us together? For Joe, it's an example. You know, a tragedy does it. The dog park does it. What's left that can bring us together and replace what's being lost?
Well, that's the $100,000 question. And I've got a few ideas that I write about in my book of ways to augment the opportunities and the motivation for us to meet people who have different points of view and may live near us or who would normally fill those middle ring slots in our social constellation. The point that Joe made is well taken. I actually had an interesting interaction after I did an interview a week or two ago. I learned that the folks who do background checks now for the FBI and for the federal government are finding it more and more difficult in many circumstances to get information from people's neighbors because they don't know one another anymore.
Oh, that's a very interesting consequence of what you're talking about.
Exactly right. So that these sorts of the web of information that once existed in the neighborhood and that we tapped into for a whole variety of purposes just like that, someone's sick, if there's an elderly woman down the street whose kids have moved away, are there people to fill in when she needs some help? There are a whole variety of utilities to having thick middle ring relationships, and we are losing those. The one point I do want to make, the book's argument is not that middle ring relationships have disappeared. And I think it would be very interesting, and if I ever have an opportunity to write a second book or can find data that would describe this, it'd be interesting to know in what communities in America the middle rings are thicker and where they're thinner. Which communities are spending more social capital, so to speak, on those outer ring relationships, and which aren't? And what are the differences between the communities? Are some safer or some less safe? It'd be interesting to look at that information.
So as you say, your next book topic is ready made. Let's go to another caller. This is Pradesh from Sharon, and Pradesh, you are on the line.
Yeah, hi. So I think it's not fair to say that we are losing our contacts with our next-door neighbors. Actually, the concept of our neighbors is changing in this virtual world. A few years ago or a couple of decades ago, you really had no options but to actually say hi to your neighbor because you didn't go out as much. You couldn't meet many more people online as you are doing these days. So I think it's not very fair to say that you lose the connection with the middle ring, so to speak.
Pradesh, thank you. Mark, you want to defend your premise?
Yeah, that's an interesting concept. He's absolutely right that we are not more isolated than we used to be. In fact, the online networks now give us much more opportunity to meet a wider array of people. Tom Friedman, in his last book, talked about how people in Manhattan and Mumbai are now virtual neighbors. It was an interesting and profound point. But the truth is that neighbors, that's a very specific kind of relationship. It's a relationship that involves knowing more than you would know just by having someone's email address, right? That's a relationship with someone who you know their kids, you know their face, you know what car they drive, where they work, in many cases. That is the classic neighborly relationship. Now we've got all sorts of opportunities, and the caller is exactly right, that The issue is that we now have opportunities to make other choices in ways that we did not. And we are choosing, in fact, to abandon these middle ring relationships and invest more time and energy in different buckets.
Listeners, I'm talking with Mark Dunkelman of Brown University, the author of The Vanishing Neighbor. He writes about how we may be close to, as he puts it, the people we wake up to in the morning. Those relationships remain intimate. We may have regular contact with the person we buy coffee from every day. But are the people on your block, the people in your community, are those relationships weakening? And if they are, what are the consequences of that? We want to know your own experiences with your neighbors. And what do you think it means if you feel a sense of embarrassment or guilt that you don't know the people who live around you? 1-800-423-8255. Again, that's 1-800-423-TALK here on Radio Boston. And let's go to Ryan calling from Somerville. Ryan, you're on the air.
Hi, Sasha. I guess, you know, I've been thinking about this, and I definitely, you know, feel, you know, what your guest is talking about. I grew up in kind of rural suburban New Hampshire, moved to Boston for school, and I've kind of stuck around. And one of the things I've really had to get used to is, you know, having neighbors that are kind of keeping tabs on me, that I interact with on a regular basis. And I almost feel like I was never really socialized to know how to interact with neighbors, you know, so closely. And I wonder if, you know, that's ever come up, or just the idea of a lot of people kind of moving from suburban areas back into the city and kind of not knowing that, you know, code of conduct. You know, if that's ever come up in your guest's research. Or...
Ryan, you feel like having grown up in the suburbs that put you at a disadvantage in terms of knowing your neighbors? Because I would think most people think the suburbs are the place where you know your neighbors better than if you lived in the city.
I don't know. I guess, you know, in my experience growing up, it, you know, everything was very spread out and, you know, you could barely see your neighbor's home. There'd be a fence or a decent amount of distance, a decent amount of land, where now, you know, I'm living in a triple-decker and there's houses really close together up and down my street. You know, I've never really had to share a living space like that until I moved to the city, and that's been a very different experience, you know, having neighbors like that that live just downstairs, not, you know, a quarter mile down the road. And I don't know, I mean, I just feel like, you know, a city is somewhere where you're really, you know, you're more closely interacting with that middle ring of people because you're just physically closer together.
Ryan, thank you for that. Thank you for that point. That's very interesting. Mark, have you seen in the work you did sort of a city-suburban divide on this point?
This shift has happened broadly speaking, and it sounds like Ryan actually has had an experience the opposite of what I note is the broad experience, which is that he's gone from a situation where he had fairly thin middle rings to ones where he had thicker middle rings. The experience is happening everywhere. It's happening in urban areas, suburban areas, rural areas. It's not universal. It's not happening to every person. It's not happening to every community. But the broad trend is that Americans more frequently are spending time with their families or with their most intimate contacts with people that they know only on a single level of shared affinity, and they've lost these middle rings. The interesting point that I took from the caller, actually, is that the definition of neighborliness has changed over the course of the last several decades. In the early post-war years, being neighborly meant bringing over a plate of cookies when someone moved in and knowing what was happening in someone's life. Today, in many cases, neighborly means exactly the opposite. It means that if you hear an argument between people through the wall, you look away when you see them the next day, and you certainly don't ask about them. Neighborliness now means affording a modicum of privacy to people who live nearby. And that's a pretty dramatic shift in what it means to be a neighbor.
I want to take a caller from Connecticut. This is Corey calling from Manchester, Connecticut. And Corey, you are on the air on Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, I was listening to Pradesh a little bit earlier on the definition of neighborliness, and I thought back on a documentary I saw 5 years ago, and it was on India. And, you know, as it relates to the U.S., what I heard was it was interesting. The gentleman that was speaking was talking about the urbanization of India and how the history of India, a lot of times when you were in a neighborhood, you would walk by a house and there was no need for a door. As a matter of fact, there was no door. If you walked by a house, you could see right inside, you could wave, and you'd see if someone was home. And as urbanization increased, what they spoke of was the high-rises and the apartment complex, whereby doors became necessary, walls became necessary, if not for security, whatever other reason. and it created a gap between the neighbors. And I found it interesting as it related to his comment, because I think that it, you know, we have these walls, and very many times they are physical walls that separate us.
Interesting. Corey, thank you for that call as well. Mark Dunkelman, your thoughts on that?
I think it's an interesting point. There are certainly more opportunities now for people to reach out to people exactly who they want to speak with, right? If you are interested in one very small topic now, it's possible for you to find someone who agrees with that point of view. So the impulse now, if you are an enthusiast of Corvettes, maybe Corvettes from the 60s, you no longer have to spend time with someone who likes Firebirds from the 70s who happens to live in your neighborhood, because it's much easier to find someone who likes exactly.
Mark, I think we've lost you. Let me see if we can get you back on the line. All right. While we try to get Mark back, let's go to a caller from Arlington. This is Carol. Oh, I'm sorry. Mark, you back with us? We lost you briefly. Are you back?
I am.
Okay. You were telling us about previously you'd have to go to the Firebird neighbor down the line, and now you can sort of go to the world of sort of car lovers.
Right. So there are two elements here. One is the opportunity, and that speaks to the previous caller's question about whether there are walls separating people who live nearby. And the second is, what is your motive? What is it that you want from the limited time that you have to socialize each day? And in many more cases, we're much more interested in having the return we get from these very intimate connections and these less intimate connections.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because before we lose our time with you, you also make this connection in your book, which I have to tell you, I originally thought it was sort of a leap or a stretch, in which you say that sort of the weakening of these middle-tier neighborly relationships actually has led in some ways to the political dysfunction we see in Washington. And I thought, how do you connect those dots? But it's quite interesting. Tell us how you believe that sometimes when we carefully narrow and surround ourselves with people who share our views, that can connect to dysfunction we see in politics.
There's a political scientist at Stanford named James Fishkin, who's run a series of experiments over the course of the past quarter century, where he takes a representative sample of a population, pulls them on an issue of some contention, puts them in a room and lets them talk at some length about the issue with people who hold the other point of view, and then pulls them again. And what he finds is that in almost every case, there is significant movement, that once people have spoken to people who have an articulate, thoughtful position on the other side, people are more willing, if not to agree with them, but to a compromise or to see some sort of accommodation. In our everyday lives today, if you aren't in touch in those middle ring relationships with someone who has the other point of view, if there's nobody at the coffee shop you talk to, or an independent business person, or at the university, or in your place of work, or down the street, who will say to you, here's why I think this. I disagree with you on that. I respect your point of view, but this is what I think. It's much harder for you to go into your house in the absence of that interaction and read on the news that your member of Congress has reached across the aisle, because the other side, absent that individual personal experience, seems crazy, right? There's no personal experience that you have that says, I understand why they're saying that. I don't agree, but I understand why. Because that is actually the first step toward some sort of mutual accommodation.
Mark, we have run out of time, but we have a full board of callers who wanted to weigh in, and I just want to summarize two things based on the little notes that our producer has written up about the issues the callers want to talk about. Many people seem to be weighing in about sort of the physical setup of their neighborhood. So, for example, someone moved from a neighborhood of two-car garages to one-car garages. With only one garage, people spent more time on the street or on the sidewalk. He felt like that promoted neighborliness. And someone makes the point that when you have kids, they believe you're more likely to meet neighbors. So certainly many factors, it seems, in terms of the setup and the family structure. So a very interesting issue that many people have many interesting thoughts about. Thank you very much for talking about this. Mark Dunkelman is a research fellow at Brown University's Taubman Center for Public Policy and American Institutions. He has a new book out called The Vanishing Neighbor, The Transformation of American Community. Mark, thanks for talking about this.
Thanks for having me on.
Stay with us. Coming up, a Massachusetts company that just received FDA approval to sell a motorized exoskeleton that can enable some paraplegics to walk again. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.